All rise. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Bruce Castle presiding. All that business before this court draw near and shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Amen.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Chief Judge Castle. To my right is Judge Hagel. To my left is Judge Mormon. We're here today in the matter of Andrea McNair, docket number 091813. The counsel for the parties, please note your appearance for the record.
Troy Graybell on behalf of Ms. McNair.
Okay. And who's with you?
This is Rod Smith, also Finnegan Henderson on behalf of Ms. McNair.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yeah.
Each party will have 30 minutes to present argument. Mr. Grabo, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, I'd like to reserve 8 minutes for rebuttal, please.
8 minutes it is.
Thank you.
You may begin.
May it please the court. Ms. McNair suffers from neuralgia in the form of chronic and debilitating pain as a direct outcome of her surgery at a VA medical hospital in June 1998. The VA acknowledges that neuralgia is a foreseeable risk of the veteran's surgery. The VA, however, did not warn Ms. McNair of this foreseeable neuralgia. The VA was negligent by not obtaining Ms. McNair's full and informed consent as required by the statute and its own regulation. Ms. McNair is therefore entitled to benefits under Section 1151. The burden is on the government to establish that it obtained Ms. McNair's full and informed consent by warning her of the foreseeable risk of painful neuralgia. Because the government cannot establish that full and informed consent was obtained, my client prevails under the statute. Here, three pieces of evidence point towards a finding that the government did not obtain full and informed consent. First, Ms. McNair signed a generic or blank consent form. As with a generic consent form in Halcom, it does not list any description of the risks that may have been discussed.
So is that consent form of no value whatsoever, evidentially speaking?
I believe it's of evidentiary value. You must consider it along with the other evidence, such as the statements by the veteran that we'll be discussing, as well as the corroborating preoperative note by Dr. Wasserman. So I believe, yes, you certainly must consider it. And the court in Halcom certainly would expect, this court, fairly reading Halcom, would expect us to consider it as part of this. Second, unlike in Halcom, we have two affirmative statements by Ms. McNair in the record that she was not warned of the risks of painful neuralgia from nerve regeneration.
You state in your brief that the board never determined the credibility of Ms. McNair.
I believe we stated that they did not challenge. I'm sure you're right, Your Honor.
The board never concluded that Ms. McNair was not credible.
Correct. So I believe the way I would phrase it is that they did not challenge the credibility of Ms. McNair.
Does that mean they accepted it?
They did not challenge it, therefore I believe it's taken as accepted. The third important aspect of this case is that...
You stated in your brief that the physician report lists risks that VA specifically disclosed to the veteran but did not include neuralgia. And while that's true, didn't that statement from the record indicate that it was a detailed briefing and including some specific ones?
Well, yeah, actually what it says that the nature of the operation, including some trade-offs we've discussed in great detail, and then it says including the potential complications of...
So what would the trade-offs be?
The trade-off said it listed, and this is at the record at 452, it could be cosmetic trade-offs. It could be, recovery time. Yeah, it could, trade-offs could include risks.
So we have two includings in that statement that you just read, do we not?
Yes, we have two includings.
So why would you say so definitively that the record only excluded neuralgia?
Well,
or am I overreading what you wrote?
I think you're overreading, and now's a great chance for us to clarify that if it wasn't clear in the brief. There's a long list of risks detailed in the preoperative note. And one
this
of them...
This is not one of them.
This is not one of them.
Does that mean it wasn't included?
It doesn't per se mean it wasn't included. You need to look at all of the evidence in the record. And that includes, for instance, the veteran's testimony, as well as there's certainly no affirmative statement by the VA or by the doctor here that they did discuss the risk of painful neuralgia. I think that's very important here. And with respect to the preoperative note, our position is that this preoperative note by the surgeon done at 8:30 in the morning, that this corroborates the veteran's specific testimony in two different instances, and that is very important that although this lists a large number of complications, it doesn't list the very complication that she later suffered from.
So you state on in your brief that the board ignored her statements.
The board gave passing reference. It recognized her statements, but it did not give them. They didn't give them the weight that they were due. And we recognize here that Ms. McNair signed a blank generic consent form that's similar to that in Halcombe. But we think that any consent that can be implied from this generic form is contradicted by the veteran's repeated testimony in two instances in the record, which is also corroborated by Dr. Wasserman's preoperative note. And as I stated
now,
before...
Now, the extent to which you're arguing that it's corroborated by Dr. Wasserman's preoperative note, what you're really doing is you're drawing an inference from what isn't in the note. And so you would have the court infer that the absence of a mention somehow corroborates her statements as to what she was not told. Is that correct?
I don't really see it as drawing an inference. What I see it analyzed is that the VA has got the duty to obtain the full and informed consent and to establish that they obtain the full and informed consent.
What if Dr. Wasserman's preoperative note had neglected to mention scars? Now, clearly there was going to be a scar resulting from this surgery, whether it was a clean scar or some other kind of scar. Surgery results in scarring. Would your client be entitled to benefits under 1151 in that situation?
I'm really not sure. I mean, that's not the facts of this case. She's not trying to...
Well, what if you had left out hematoma and she suffered a hematoma? Would your client be entitled to benefits under 1151?
That sounds similar to the facts of this case with respect to, you know, neuralgia not being mentioned and then she later suffered from it.
What if he hadn't listed anything specifically and he had simply said, I have advised comprehensively Ms. McNair of all of the risks of this surgery as they're known widely among surgeons? Would that be of no value?
Well, I think that would certainly be of value. We would look at it and we would weigh that in light of the blank consent form, and we'd weigh that in light of the veteran's testimony.
So if that's the situation, And that's what you would like the court to, that's the way the, you would like the court to read this, then wouldn't that, the natural result of that be to encourage VA to have their surgeons write pages of boilerplate into pre-op notes in order to cover all possible consequences of the surgery?
I don't think that's true. I think in this situation, they had a discussion, and he summarized the discussion, but I mean, he didn't summarize the discussion to include, you know, a very foreseeable risk that the VA and everyone has admitted is a foreseeable risk. I think if you include a list like this, it's going to be used as evidence against the VA if it doesn't include a foreseeable risk that any medical practitioner would know can result from the breast augmentation.
So then a careful surgeon would list every conceivable foreseeable risk in the pre-op notes. And wouldn't that result in page on page? I mean, we've seen this in other areas of VA practice. I mean, you start, you know, with a small principle, and the next thing you know, you have five pages of boilerplate. Is that, you know, the result that you think is appropriate from the direction that your argument takes us?
Well, I mean, I get no record evidence to cite whether, I'm not sure how long these lists would be. I don't think the slippery slope that you're envisioning and that I can see that the court being worried about would take place. I don't see this. If you look at the list right there, it was only about maybe four or five lines or something like that. I don't think this is going to be pages upon pages. Just if you're going to list the foreseeable complications, you should include all the foreseeable complications that were discussed.
Let me ask you this question then. You said that there are three pieces of evidence here. Isn't there also evidence that Ms. McNair had explained to her that part of this breast reduction surgery that she would undergo involved the removal of the nipple area, the storage of that, of those pieces of tissue in a petri dish, and then the reattachment? And wouldn't that naturally inform somebody that there might be nerve damage? Or wouldn't that naturally lead to a discussion of nerve damage, potential nerve damage?
Let me answer your question. Yes, the preoperative note, I believe you're referring to the mention of the graft loss in the procedure. But my answer to your second question, is it whether a person would reasonably know? A person who's not a medical practitioner would not reasonably know and is not expected to know about a medical condition such as nerve regeneration post-operative that causes extreme pain. Medical practitioners are held to that standard, but there's a lot of cases in this court hold that the foreseeable risk is looked at through the eyes of a medical practitioner, and the veteran is not held to the standard of a medical professional.
Thank you.
What is meant in the regulation? Well, let me back up. It seems like you're saying that if the doctor did not specifically provide information with regard to a possible adverse outcome, that there's a strict liability associated with that. All right, then what are the exceptions to the strict liability?
Your Honor, we're not arguing strict liability if the doctor's note does not mention a specific foreseeable risk.
The doctor didn't mention it to the patient.
Okay.
Are you advocating strict liability?
If the doctor does not warn of a specific risk under the full and informed consent statute, we believe that the VA is liable.
Then what's meant by, in the regulation, 3.361 D1, sure. Rule 2I. Minor deviations from the requirements of 1732 that are immaterial under the circumstances of a case.
Absolutely. Thank you for that question. I believe that that refers to situations such as, for instance, if there is a consent form, let's say, that has got the wrong date on it, or let's say they, instead of using the term painful neuralgia, they use the term post-generative long-term pain. Could be something that spells her name wrong. I think these are really supposed to be minor deviations from the requirement under the statute of full and informed consent.
And it's under the circumstances of the case.
And it's absolutely under the circumstances.
So in this case, this was not really totally elective surgery. I mean, VA provided the surgery for her, right?
The VA provided the surgery
for
her. For
her health, is that correct?
Yes, this was not deemed to be a cosmetic surgery.
So wouldn't one of the determinations have to be whether or not she would have made the decision to proceed with the operation in any event if she wasn't told that she had sensitivity later on?
Yeah, I don't believe that's a requirement. Once the VA undergoes a procedure, they need to provide the full and informed consent. And I don't believe I've seen any case law that says that the issue, the judges need to make a determination of whether she would have gone through
it. Did you check
it
the case law outside with regard to medical malpractice and informed consent?
I'm aware of some of the cases that were cited in the district courts, many of which had been distinguished from the VA having a very different system than in the civil practice and in the district courts.
I have a question on one of the comments that you made, and I'm not sure I caught exactly what you said. You made a comment about whether or not absent the or the failure to inform Ms. McNair that neuralgia is a possible consequence of this would lack informed consent without any evidence in the record that she would have foregone the procedure with such consent. I'm not sure I can phrase that properly. In other words, as an element of showing lack of informed consent, does Ms. McNair have to state, or does the record have to provide, that Ms. McNair would not have gone through the procedure if she were informed of the possibility of neuralgia?
I don't believe the case law states that.
Believe the case law states that, yeah. Or does the case law state the opposite? Because there is case law that does support that.
I'm not sure how to answer that. I know what I'd like to focus on.
Well, it's a simple question. Yes or no is the answer. Do you know the answer or don't you?
I don't know the answer.
Okay, thank you.
What I'd like you to focus on, I think what the issue isn't whether or not she would or would not have gone through
that's what you think, but you don't know, right? Okay.
That's correct.
Now, why is it that we should listen to your argument about what you think as opposed to what the law is?
I apologize.
Or why you think, cases that you know should be interpreted in a certain way.
Okay. Your Honor, in this case, we have the record evidence, however, of the veteran that states that she was not warned of the foreseeable risk.
Okay, I agree. Let's assume I agree with your position, but that's the case. Go ahead.
Okay.
Let's take that as a given.
Okay. And as you said, there's no contrary evidence in the record, either oral or written,
let's assume that's
contradicts
given.
This.
I'll assume that's a given.
Let's see. The VA admits here in this case that the additional disability was caused by the operation.
A given.
And I guess I'll wrap things up if you don't have any further questions.
If you don't mind, I have a couple of other questions.
Sure.
Okay. Now, I just want to make sure that I'm correct that there are a number of elements that are listed, they're required under the regulation to be present to show informed consent. As I understand your argument, you're limiting your argument, or I shouldn't say limiting, your argument is that informed consent was not obtained because Ms. McNair was not informed of the possible consequence of neuralgia, and therefore her consent was not informed. Is that correct?
That, in addition to the record evidence that she has put forth, which distinguishes from
Holcomb. I understand, but that's the claim that's the sole error that you're proceeding on, correct?
Yes, that okay. Summarizes it.
All right. Now, the standard for us, what we need to do is not find those facts in and of themselves, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So we have to determine whether or not the board's finding of those facts was, the conclusion they reached, was based upon a fact-finding that was clearly erroneous. Do you agree with that?
I'd like to modify that. I think on further reflection after the briefing, that we believe that this is the application of law, undisputed law, undisputed facts.
Okay, so, but don't we have still to determine whether the VA, whether the board's conclusion on the facts was clearly erroneous before we can move forward to the application of those facts to the law?
Well, I don't see any facts in the record that have been disputed, by the VA or by us in the record with respect to the consent form or the postoperative note.
So your position then is all of the givens that I mentioned earlier, assuming that the VA would concede those, then all we have to do then is take those facts, which are conceded, and apply them here. And it seems to me the only fact that I see that might be at issue is whether or not the facts found in the record reasonably support the conclusion that the board drew that this was a minor, even assuming it was true, that the failure to advise about the possibility of neuralgia was a minor element, or that it must have been included because there was a detailed discussion. That was a conclusion that the board reached, right?
Yes, that's
an accurate. So we would have to find, if we agreed with that conclusion, if we didn't find it clearly erroneous, then we would have to affirm.
We have time. Do you want to continue this now, or do you want to pick it up later? We
can if you would think about that on rebuttal, I'd like to hear a little bit about that, if you would.
Okay, I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May proceed. Ms. King.
Reversal is not warranted in this case. In the board's January 22nd.
Could I just follow up on those questions?
Absolutely.
While it's fresh in my mind?
Sure.
Do you agree or disagree with the fact that the neuralgia was caused by the surgery?
Both sides have conceded that it was a foreseeable risk, that there was additional disability as a result of the surgery.
And do you agree that, or disagree that there was failure to disclose this as far as the record is concerned?
That is the point of contention, in that our position is that...
Oh, is there any direct evidence of disclosure?
The question is whether or not the...
Yes or no?
No. There is not a direct statement in the record that indicates neuralgia or nerve damage was part of the preoperative note. However, the Secretary's contention is that reversal is not warranted in this case, as there was substantial compliance in that the consent process was appropriately documented as required under 17.32D. Indeed, in this particular case, there are a couple of factual issues that it's important to note that at 6:45 in the morning, the veteran signed the informed consent form. And that was in the brief it had... Okay.
I'm sorry. I know I'm stopping you, and I apologize.
That's fine.
I still have this in line of question in my mind, and if I could,
sure.
I'd like to get the Secretary's position on this. Does the Secretary contend or agree or disagree that there is a requirement that the individual in some house, you know, state or the records show that but for the absence of this particular disclosure, in this case, she would not have gone through the procedure?
This is the area that Halcombe left off on, and in that...
Well, Halcombe just said that there, as I remember the case, just said that there was no statement at all contesting whether or not there was disclosure or non-disclosure. What I'm asking is a different question. Does, in order to raise the issue of informed consent, doesn't there have to be some sort of link between the failure, I mean, the lack of informed consent and the actual surgery? In other words, if an individual is not informed and they go ahead and have the surgery, and if there's no evidence that they would have foregone the surgery, if in fact they were told of this, is it the Secretary's position that the issue of informed consent is raised or not?
Yes, there's reasonable guidance in Parkins v. U.S., which is a district court case that was mentioned in Halcombe. And although there's certainly a dichotomy
here... Well, what's the Secretary's
here,
position? Not what the case said. I just need
the
to
regulation
know
the does not require any sort of causation. And to date, this court's precedent doesn't give any guidance as to whether there should be...
Mr. Secretary, what is your position with regard to this?
That there should be some sort of test of causation as to whether a reasonable person who was informed decided to...
The Secretary believes there's a reasonable person standard. So what we should do is look at, not Ms. McNair, but would a reasonable person facing this type of surgery, would it be a significant factor in determining whether or not to have the surgery? And if they were informed of this, they would forego the surgery?
I think, yes, Your Honor. Okay. That is a reasonable assumption. There is no precedent.
Wait a minute. Is that the Secretary's position?
The Secretary's position is yes. In addition, in getting into the evaluation or the evidentiary value of a lay statement, essentially a statement that informed consent was not received, the Secretary's position is that the presumption of regularity should attach to the process itself. In that, in this particular case, 17. The board's finding that the requirements of 17.32 C and D is not the only permissible view of the evidence. At 6:45 a.m., the veteran signed the requisite OF 522 form, which is the standard form that's required, that simply states generically that she understood the attendant risks involved, the nature of the procedure. At 8:30 on the same morning, the attending physician met with her again to discuss additional risks, and that was consistent at the time with 17.32C. It was also consistent with VHA guidelines, which required the OF 522 in addition to a progress note. Under the guidelines and consistent with the reg, only a statement.
Did the board find that she was informed?
Yes.
Where?
They found that there was substantial compliance with 17.32.
Did that mean that she was informed of neuralgia?
Yes.
Where does it say that?
It says specifically on page 13 of the board's decision.
Why don't you read to me where it says it?
says the additional disability due to neuralgia of the breast was a foreseeable risk of the June 1998 surgery for which the veteran provided informed consent. That is the key issue. It's whether or not she provided her informed consent. It is not whether every recitation...
Okay, let me just go to that. You're citing the board finds that the additional disability due to neuralgia of the breast or focal nerve damage was a foreseeable risk of the June 98 surgery for which the veteran provided informed consent. And as you just stated it, you're reading that to say that she gave informed consent for that risk?
In addition,
or she gave informed consent for the surgery?
That she gave informed consent, that the informed consent process, which is
I understand all that. Just try and stay with me. I want to know, do you read that first sentence as saying provided informed consent for the risk
informed,
or for the surgery?
Informed consent for the risk. And
okay,
that is
fine. I understand your position.
Okay.
I'm not sure I agree with you, but I understand your position. Is there anywhere else in this record where the board found that the claimant was provided notice of neuralgia being a possible outcome?
They did find later in that paragraph.
All right,
that,
where?
It says at the very, very bottom, to the extent that the June 2nd, 1998 surgeon's report as to potential complications of the procedure failed to document the specific risk of neurologic
scarring. All right, now, forgive me, but that doesn't say that they're finding that he was informed, she was informed. That's finding that, assuming she wasn't informed. Where, is there anywhere else in this board decision where they found that the claimant was informed that neuralgia was a risk, other than that first sentence that you said?
They don't specifically say that neuralgia
was a risk. So they don't make any finding like that?
No, the pertinent and relevant finding in this case is whether or not the process... there was substantial compliance.
What does
with
it mean when they say on page 13, a sentence above that, there's no regulatory requirement that every possible foreseeable risk be listed, only the reasonable ones? I assume that's what they mean, right?
That is correct.
And you've already conceded, the Secretary has conceded that this was a reasonable foreseeable risk?
Yes.
Now, what's the second part of that mean? And based upon the evidence in this case, a reasonable person could assume that the surgeon's detailed discussion addressing possible residual scarring includes associated neuralgic pain.
Yes, and that, Your Honor, that is based on specifically the evidence in the record. The doctor in the progress note discussed the nature of the operation, including trade-offs, scar and side effects, which included
scar.
So
is this the board saying, I'm just trying to understand the sentence. I understand that part. Well, what's the board saying here? That they are a reasonable person, that they concluded? I mean, what are they trying to say here?
The reasonable person standard has never been set. They're acknowledging her lay statement, or her statement of non-receipt, essentially, that she did not receive informed consent. They're acknowledging that, but they're stating that under the guidelines of the regulation, and this is consistent with the VHA handbook as well as HALCOM, that not every risk that is discussed with the patient needs to be transcribed into the record.
I agree with that. Now, what does it mean when they say, upon the evidence in this case, a reasonable person could assume, number one, are they saying that they are the reasonable person?
They are basing the reasonable person's...
Are they saying that they could assume or that they are assuming?
That they could assume.
So did they or didn't they?
They did assume in this case, based on their finding, that there was substantial compliance with 17.32C.
So then hasn't the board member in this case given more weight to the assumption of compliance than to the veteran's statement that there was no notice?
Yes, and the second...
And what supports that weighing against the veteran's statement that I was not given notice?
The presumption of regularity. In this particular case, the presumption of regularity would assume that the government official has in good faith, in other words, the doctor has in good faith followed the law, and in the informed consent context, that means that they have complied with 17.32D, which is appropriately documenting the process. In other words, VHA has set the guidelines so that not every risk discussed. It's a conversation that the operative report in this case was a conversation with the veteran that was simultaneously taken at the point in time that he is actually describing that he has discussed in great detail the risks and complications of the procedure. And
as a matter of fact, under VA's regs, can't you assume that all of these specifics that Dr. Wasserman put in were gratuitous?
Yes, they were gratuitous. In fact, he only
But once Dr. Wasserman starts down that road, doesn't he have an obligation to get to the end of it?
In this case, he specifically discussed the details of the procedure and many of the complications, including scar, and specifically, this is critical to note in this case, partial or incomplete nipple areolar complex graft loss. This procedure, the nature of this procedure, required a free nipple areolar grafting, a skin graft. In other words, the nipple was removed from the blood tissue. Inherent in that procedure is sensory changes will be inherent in that procedure
and
by the nature of
with the amount of detail that Dr. Wasserman put in this note, why wouldn't he have said, and attendant neurological damage?
He stated including. The list was meant to be illustrative, not exclusionary, which is consistent with Halcombe.
Well, is there a burden shifting that goes on here when the veteran
yes.
comes back and says, I wasn't told this? Now where does your presumption of regularity stand?
Under the presumption of regularity, a statement of non-receipt alone is insufficient to rebut the presumption.
Well, are you going to the mailing cases now?
I think that fits, the presumption of regularity would fit within this context in that although the majority of cases have dealt with procedural or ministerial acts, as recently as Parrish v. Shinseki, the court found a presumption of regularity attached to the delegation process. And Judge Davis's concurring opinion in Parrish and Judge Hagel, your concurring opinion in Johnson, raised the concern that in finding that the presumption of regularity attaches, the concern was that the evidence was exclusively in VA's control. However, that's not the case in the context of informed consent, where the veteran has access to the medical records. Additionally, a presumption of regularity
Let me back up on that statement. Doesn't our case law say that a veteran without an uneducated veteran, uneducated in the terms of medical procedure, facts, theory, or whatever, is not presumed to be able to determine technical, you know, issues with regard to medicine? And in that case, isn't the VA physician solely in control of that information?
The VA, yes, Your Honor, the VA physician is in control of the medical evidence. However, the medical opinion. However, under the cases of Cox and Rizzo, there is a presumption that the physician has the credentials and is competent.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying your statement was that you wanted to distinguish the other cases, Parrish, Johnson, and so forth, because in this case, the VA did not have control of the information. But that's not really true.
That's not the sole issue. It really would be the presumption of regularity can be rebutted.
Correct.
Not a statement of
non-receipt
alone.
How would it be rebutted in this case?
In this case, in the context of informed consent, presumption of regularity could be rebutted if there's no evidence that there is a signed consent form. If there's no evidence
that... You don't even get it unless you have a signed consent form, do you? I mean, are you saying you get a presumption of regularity without a signed consent form? Just the fact that the person
No, you wouldn't. The presumption wouldn't.
All right, so you have a signed consent form.
You have a signed consent form.
All right, how do you rebut it?
There testimony from the physician. There is a witness statement, testimony or a statement from the witness. Family members that are there at the time, testimony in that regard. That could be used to rebut the presumption of regularity in this
case. Did the board member in this case analyze any of that?
No, the board member did not. However, Halcombe was issued in October 2009. This board decision is January 2009. And Halcombe
Well, the board member always had a reasons or basis obligation.
They did, and they found that in weighing the probative value, essentially implicit in the decision, they found that the medical evidence...
But what's their analysis? Let me see. Their analysis is the positive of the evidence is against, right?
The analysis is on page 11, and it gives a one-paragraph analysis acknowledging the veteran's lay statement and finding that in this particular case, the veteran was their substantial compliance with the 17.32C.
Without any analysis as to why, right?
They simply found that any deviation was minor. However, in this particular case, it's a critical factor.
Meant by minor deviation? You had a discussion previously, I think, with Judge Hagel. Is this where the evidence would have to show one way or another, be weighed by the board as to whether or not the claimant would have proceeded with the procedure even if they had been informed of this?
That would be a reasonable assessment of a minor deviation, especially in light of the fact that in this particular case, the doctor did specifically describe partial or incomplete nipple areolar graft loss, and she has sensory loss in the nipple area due to the skin grafting. It's entirely logical that in the breadth of those terms that the VA examiner used in the progress note, he discussed all the risks associated with those particular terms. He's simply documenting the process here.
Focusing in on that paragraph, would you explain to me the last phrase that the board member used that looks to me like a finding that it's immaterial under the circumstances of this case is to inform consent? The minor deviations are immaterial? How are they immaterial on the facts of this case?
They're immaterial on the facts of this case because there was substantial compliance with the regulation and VHA handbook as to the process. She signed a VA form OF-522 at 6:45 in the morning where she was explained the attendant risk, the nature of the operation in great detail. Subsequent to that, there was a conversation, the statement from the examiner stating that he discussed the complications and side effects of the procedure in great detail. And he included a list that included the fact that it was partial or incomplete nipple areolar graft loss. Additionally, in this case, a week after the surgery, the veteran called the examiner and stated that it felt her nipples were falling off. And he specifically stated it's sloughing of the tissue and not to be concerned so long as there's healthy tissue underneath. Although the veteran did not recall that conversation, the examiner specifically stated he discussed that risk preoperatively. But sloughing of the tissue...
Is there anything in this record that indicates that Dr. Wasserman recalled what he told her?
There's nothing in this. No, there's nothing in this record that Dr. Wasserman submitted.
When did Ms. McNair first raise this issue with regard to a lack of informed consent? Do you remember?
I believe she filed her claim in November 1998, and this the procedure took place in 1998.
But when did she first claim lack of informed consent?
In November 1998, she claimed that she was not warned of the possibility of pain.
Don't you think it would have been helpful to the board member if somebody had gone back and said to Dr. Wasserman, did you discuss this with the claimant?
Yes, Your Honor, it would have been helpful if there was a statement from the doctor.
And so in place of that, which would have been real evidence, the board member relied on an inference to give greater weight to what isn't in the record than the board member gave to the veteran's testimony as to what she was not told. Am I correct?
No, Your Honor. There is the critical aspect of this case is that the regulation and VHA handbook require only a recitation or a statement that the discussion was explained, that the nature of the operation was explained, that attendant
assuming that I agree with you in that regard, Dr. Wasserman went further than that. He listed specifics.
And our position is that he listed specifics that encapsulate the breadth of those terms it logically follows that in his discussion of partial or incomplete nipple areolar graft loss, where there was a skin graft, and she subsequently suffers from nerve damage, which the January 2005 VA examiner explicitly stated nerve damage is possible in any procedure. And the 2008 examiner stated that the risk of sensory loss was due to both surgeries, as this was her second breast reduction, that the requirements of 17.32 have been met, and that is consistent, congruent with this court's holding in Halcombe, in which critically the court found that there was no VHA handbook, and the regulation did not require a specific recitation of every risk that was discussed. So in other words, it could not be presumed that the risk was not discussed simply because it was not included in the progressive progress note. If the presumption of regularity applies, then a mere statement by the veteran that she did not receive informed consent would be insufficient to rebut the fact that the examiner is required to, by law, to have a detailed discussion of reasonably foreseeable risks. And in this particular case, the veteran's lay statement alone is insufficient to rebut the presumption that the examiner had followed VHA guidelines and the regulation.
Where in the record is the November 98 lack of informed consent first raised by the claimant?
Her claim, the veteran's claim was filed. Let's see, 503, 504, that was when the claim was filed.
And what was the claim?
The claim was for the neuralgia and the pain suffered from the
procedure. Okay, so when was informed consent raised?
And she stated in 599, in May of 1999, that she was never informed of the possibility of nerve damage.
So is it May of 99 or is it November of 98 that informed consent was first raised?
The specific statement that she was not warned of the possibility of pain with neuralgia, I believe, was in May 1999. The statement in the 11-1998 claim was more vague.
It wasn't vague. It was for the pain and
For the pain and neuralgia. But the specific statement that is referenced by...
Which is in response to a regional office that said...
That denied the claim, yes.
Because it was expected.
Because it was expected, yes. Alternatively, reversal is not warranted in this case for the board's discussion of appellant's lay statement that she did not provide informed consent. In the briefs, the appellant had raised the issue of Davison v. Shinseki for the proposition that there needed to be a credibility analysis in this particular case. However, in the context of informed consent, a lay statement of non-receipt is very different than a lay statement expressing continuity of symptomatology in a service connection.
So you're saying even if the board believed the veteran, you did not get this notice, it would not overcome the presumption that you would like to attach to the informed consent document and the medical record?
No, it would take a review of the entirety of the record. And in this particular case, we have a VA form.
If the mother came in, if the mother had been there and heard the informed consent and we had two people saying it, that could overcome it. But the board believing the one person couldn't overcome it.
That would be evidence that the board would have to determine whether that was clear evidence to rebut the presumption that the VA
So it could possibly
rebut. It could possibly. It would depend on the circumstances of each particular case. In conclusion... The Secretary asked.
Let me just ask you one other question before you close, and that is, what if Dr. Wasserman came in and said, I didn't advise her of that?
Then that would be evidence that would have to be evaluated. However, it would be more likely, and this is always the case, as 1151 cases, there's no statute of limitations, as opposed to a claim under the Federal Tort Claims Act, that it'd be more likely that a statement from the doctor would be indicative of, in every case where there was a second surgery or any surgery, I always inform the patient of possibility of nerve damage. So in that
context, in the development of this claim,
we don't have
anything with regard to his normal practice, what he considers acceptable risks, what he routinely advises patients undergoing this kind of surgery.
No, but again, under the presumption of regularity, the VA, our position is that the examiner followed the procedure set forth under 17.32C and substantially complied. And in conclusion, reversal is not warranted in this case, as the only permissible view is not contrary to the board's decision. As the informed consent process in this case was appropriately documented under 17.32D, and there was substantial compliance with 17.32C. As an informed consent form was signed, the progress note detailed indicated that the examiner discussed with the patient in great detail possible side effects and complications.
That's a long summary. If we don't reverse, what about remand? What's the Secretary's position on remand?
Secretary would concede to remand for the if the court finds a presumption of regularity does attach, the Secretary could concede to remand in evaluating the case law in Halcombe and in evaluating the evidentiary value of a veteran's lay statement in this particular case. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry. You do have some more time here.
Yep. 2 minutes and 9 seconds.
Why is it, I should say, we've had a lot of discussion, both, you know, from the Secretary and from Ms. McNair, that about what the facts are in this case. But I don't see them. I don't see an argument related to the standard of review and a focus on the board and their conclusion, or the board's conclusion, and whether these facts are show that their determinations are clearly erroneous or are not clearly erroneous. Now, in 1 minute and 26 seconds, can you address that?
Our position is that the board's conclusion was not clearly erroneous, in that the essential and the crux of their finding was that 17.32C was substantially complied with and any deviation was minor under 3.361. And as a result, based on the record in this particular case and the facts in this particular case, that finding was not clearly erroneous.
And as the standard we should apply, it appears there's a difference of opinion, or maybe, should we be applying the clearly erroneous standard here? If so, how? Or should we be applying the arbitrary and capricious standard?
Clearly erroneous standard in this particular in finding. If the court finds that the presumption of regularity attaches, certainly that's a de novo finding by the court. But for purposes of evaluating this board's decision as to whether at the time that this decision was rendered, whether it was clearly erroneous, the Secretary's position is that it was not clearly erroneous, and that is the standard that should be applied.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. You have 8 minutes. And did you want to pick up where you left off?
Well, perhaps you can.
All right.
You can address the question that we were discussing a minute ago. I mean, at last about informed consent and so forth.
Sure. Did you have a specific question, or I can?
Well, I asked you to consider a particular point, you know, to raise and rebuttal.
Okay. This goes to the causation requirement you'd asked me to consider. The causation requirement would, and when I say causation requirement, I'm referring to what we spoke about before, where you need to look at whether the veteran would have, colloquially speaking, gone through with the surgery. We believe this would read an additional limitation into the statute that simply isn't there. It's not supported by the statute or by the VA's own regulations, and is not a proper consideration for...
Which statute are you referring to?
If we can look at 1151, We could look at 7331, I guess would be the...
1151 doesn't even talk about informed consent. So what are you referring to?
Under 38 U.S.C. 7331.
7331?
Yes. It makes it clear that all patient care furnished in this title shall be carried out only with the full and informed consent of the patient.
So that leaves open what is meant by that?
Absolutely.
All right. So what would we be writing in there that's not in the statute? Wouldn't we look to normal interpretations that exist out there with regard to that term?
Yes, you could look at
normal. And doesn't the case law support what Judge Hagel's referring to? That the claimant would have to show, or the evidence would have to show, that the claimant would have refused this procedure that was medically called for in this case because she would have had sensitivities?
I don't believe that the VA case law supports that requirement. There have been some district courts that have discussed that. I don't believe the VA case law imposes that obligation.
Well, the statute that you quoted, doesn't it go on to say that the determination of this factor of informed consent, that the secretary will issue regulations to implement that?
Yes, it does.
So what effect does that phrase have in the statute and the VA's own regulations?
Yes, you need to look
at...
In other
words, how do we have to deal with the VA's regulations? What weight do they now carry? Given the fact that the statute specifically said, Mr. Secretary, you determine what the regulations are.
Yes, I mean, the statute specifically gives the VA the power to enact regulations, and the two regulations at issue, the 38 CFR 3.361, as well as 17.32, do not anywhere in there indicate that there would be a causation type requirement. And they're quite detailed.
What is minor deviations from the requirements of 1732 of this chapter that are immaterial under the circumstances of a case? I mean, it could be a date, as you said.
Mm-hmm. A minor deviation, we believe.
Immaterial under the circumstances. Wouldn't it be immaterial if someone would have proceeded with the operation or surgical process?
I don't think that's true. I mean, the statute and the regulation says that you need to warn of the foreseeable risks, and if you're not warned of the foreseeable risks, I don't see under that same regulation how they could then excuse a failure.
Wouldn't that be a minor deviation?
I don't believe there would be a minor
deviation. Even if you would have proceeded anyway. You could get a rash. There's no indication of a rash on here. You could get a rash or you could die. We didn't tell you about the rash. Your theory is going back to an absolute liability, strict liability, associated with the failure to inform of a adverse complication resulting from surgery.
I'm not advocating a strict liability. What I'm advocating under the facts of this case, where we've got the veteran's specific testimony that she was not warned of this.
Right, and so she wasn't warned, and wouldn't it be a minor deviation if she would have proceeded anyway?
Is
there any evidence in the record as to whether or not she would have proceeded or not?
There's no direct evidence of that, no. But we believe that this would be contrary to the statute and the regulation and the intent of them.
So what if she got a rash and she wasn't informed about a rash? Would that be a minor deviation? Or could it be considered a minor deviation under the circumstances, immaterial to the circumstances of a case where she had back problems, it was affecting her posture, et cetera, as to whether or not she proceeded with this operation? I'm just trying to figure out where you are, because I mean I'm hearing the strict liability, but then the denial of strict liability, and I'm not hearing where you think the middle is, or where you think the parameters might be formed.
I think the minor deviation would need to be, you know, for instance, in I gave a few examples about dates. Or
right, so it can't be any reasonable foreseeable risk.
But if it's a foreseeable risk that she later suffers from, then that and it needs
How about a foreseeable risk like a rash that she later suffers from but wasn't informed of it? Whether or not she would have proceeded is not an issue for consideration. All right, that's fine.
Sorry. Just a couple of points. I only got a minute and a half here.
That's true.
Your Honor, I think the crux here is that it's improper for the board to have assumed that there was a discussion of neurologic pain and can giving more weight to this assumption than is given to the veteran's
testimony. I'm just
going to
cut you a little short.
Does a presumption? Go ahead, Chief.
Where do you stand with regard to a remand because of the reasons and basis being inadequate with regard to the issues we've discussed today?
We don't support that.
You don't support a remand. Okay, thank you.
We like a remand with respect to the direct issue of informed consent and the finding that there was no informed consent and remand back for...
Right, you want a reversal on that decision.
A reversal on the decision with respect to informed consent.
What's your position with regard to this presumption of regularity being applied in this situation?
Yeah, I think the presumption of irregularity, that is to be limited to...
I think it's
to,
a presumption of regularity, but...
Sorry. Yes.
Oftentimes it feels like that you may find some irregularity here.
Often feels like it should be different, but they should be limited to ministerial acts, and it should not be...
Well, what does the Federal Circuit say about that? Didn't they reject that? All right, never mind. Did you want to continue at all? Thank you very much. Your time is up. We'll come down and greet counsel. The case will be submitted.
All rise.